Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte was supposed to get some rain over the weekend. We didn't get much. In fact, we haven't had much rain for months. We are at least 17 inches below our normal rainfall levels. We just lived through the driest January through March since 1895, and that is why most of the state is experiencing drought, with much of the western portions, including Mecklenburg and surrounding counties, in a state of extreme drought. Charlotte is already asking residents to voluntarily conserve water. If drought conditions don't improve, those voluntary restrictions could become mandatory, and a statewide burn ban is also in effect. The drought is particularly troubling to area farmers. A Union County farmer told WSOC-TV conditions are the worst he's ever seen.
I'm 42 years old, and I've never seen a drought this time of year to this extent.
Another farmer warned that if they didn't get rain this weekend, their entire crop could be at risk. He grows wheat, a crop that thrives in dry conditions, but right now, he says, it is too dry, too hot, and too early for it to be this dry. Today, a look at the atmospheric conditions causing this. We find out if any relief is in sight, examine the impact that drought, high prices for diesel and fertilizer are having on farmers, and eventually you, and what measures you can take to help. We're joined by Michelle Alfini, climate reporter for WSOC-TV. That's her story that you heard that farmer talking in. She is here with Corey Davis, assistant state climatologist at the North Carolina State Climate Office. And Dr. Jeffrey Dorfman is the Hugh C. Kiger Distinguished Professor of Agricultural and Resource Economics at North Carolina State University. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to you all. Thanks for being here.
Morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Morning. Hey, good morning.
Michelle, I'm going to start with you. How worrisome are conditions in Charlotte and the surrounding area now?
I would say pretty worrisome. I think it got very bad very quickly. A few weeks ago, when it wasn't quite as hot, things kind of seemed okay. And then it got hot and it got very dry very quickly. Things kind of went from zero to 100, and we started seeing a lot more of those water restrictions come into play.
Yeah, that farmer that we heard from a moment ago, I said, was from one of your stories on WSOC-TV Channel 9. And not only is he concerned about wheat, he is concerned about other crops as well. Talk about that for a second. I mean, how many crops? Is he talking about all crops?
Yeah, so he does wheat, soybeans, and corn, like many farmers in the region. And he says that not only is the wheat yield not looking too great right now because of the drought, but he has also only been able to plant about half of his corn because the ground is so hard, because it's so dry, his planter can't even like penetrate the soil. So he can't get the seeds in. And then in the places where he has gotten the seeds in, he says he's worried that it's so dry that the seeds won't germinate and they won't go up and grow.
That's in Union County, Jeffrey. You're the agricultural specialist here. Are farmers in all parts of the state pretty much concerned about what's going on right now?
They are. It's very dry. The soil moisture is very low. And as Michelle said, we need a certain amount of soil moisture both to physically plant crops and for them to germinate. So that first stage in the growth of a crop, soil moisture is very important.
Some farmers I read in Cabarrus County are turning to some creative ways to maybe protect their young crops as they begin to grow here, and ways to conserve water by covering them with tarps so the water doesn't evaporate. It would seem to me that if you only have a couple of acres, that might be feasible. But if you have miles and miles of land, covering that with tarps would be impractical at some point. Are there other things that farmers are doing, can do, to help lessen the effects of this drought so far?
So there's very little a farmer can do for major row crops. The scale, as you said, is just too big. You know, you either have an irrigation system or you don't. If you have irrigation, you can use it. But most farmers in North Carolina don't have irrigation, because in North Carolina agriculture, we're much more worried about hurricanes coming in from the the ocean and getting flooded. We don't think much about it being too dry.
And that could be one of our saving graces. We'll talk about hurricanes a little while from now. Michelle, I said on this program recently that I was surprised. I'm no expert. That's why I was surprised, I guess, that we are in this drought, because it was my impression, incorrect as it was, that we had a pretty wet winter. We even had a measurable snowfall, which stayed on the ground for 2 days or so, which I thought, well, that's going to be nice. But in January through March, as I mentioned in the beginning, we had the driest 3 months of those 3 months since 1895. And I think 1895 is the key year, because that's the year when we started taking measurements. When are we in a drought? What constitutes drought? Michelle.
I believe it's a rain deficit. I'm sorry, I'm not a meteorologist, so this might be a better
Okay,
question for
well,
Corey, but
Corey? Go ahead,
yeah,
Corey. You're the climatologist. I'm go ahead.
there are lots of factors that go into determining the drought status, like we see that extreme drought on the map in North Carolina. Really, a lot of that is based around precipitation, but it's not just the total amount of rainfall. We also look at the time of the year we're in. So, you mentioned that big snow event that we had in late January, early February. I think a lot of folks had hopes that that would bring us a decent amount of drought relief, not just because that was a lot of snow, but also because that was sitting on the ground for longer. Theoretically, that should give us more of a slow soak down into the soil to recharge that soil moisture that, as we've already heard, is very low at the moment. The problems were, number one, it was so cold that week after the snow, the ground stayed frozen. So we really never had a chance for that moisture to penetrate into the ground. But also, as it was sitting there, that snow, instead of melting, it converted straight back to water vapor. So it never really had a chance to improve our prospects coming out of the winter. So also, along with precipitation, we look at things like impacts. So that's things like the low soil moisture and planting conditions for farmers. We look at the river and stream levels, wildfire activity, and then even some of the water restrictions that are going in place. It is really a multifaceted determination to decide what that drought status looks like every week. I've compared it to being a detective. You can't just look at one sign to say, here's what the drought is. You have to pick up clues from each of those areas and each of those impacts. And that leads us to that direction of right now, extreme drought across a good chunk of the state.
And I also understand that moist soils attract moisture. Dry soils kind of repel it, maybe is the best way to say it. I know that over the weekend it was supposed to rain. I kept looking at my phone for radar. The radar indicated that it was raining. It was certainly cloudy, but nothing was falling, maybe a couple of drops. So is it just that it's so dry that the rain was evaporating on its way down?
One challenge we see anytime we see a prolonged dry spell like this one is that when it stays so dry, the ground really gets hardened off. And that makes it very tough for new falling rainfall to actually moisten the ground and then seep down within the ground. So a lot of times, if you're in a drought, even when you start seeing those first few rain events right after that, you really won't see much of an impact. The ground will stay dry, especially at deeper levels, just because it has not softened up enough yet for that moisture to really seep down. So I know we'll talk about the forecast, but the hope is that over this next week or two, as we get more of these regular rain events, finally that will start to bring an impact, and that especially the farmers will notice their soils are getting maybe a little bit more suitable for planting.
So Mecklenburg County is in this condition of extreme drought, along with Union, Iredell, Cabarrus, Catawba, and other counties to our west, and then a couple of counties surrounding Wake County in the other part of the state. At what point do we shift? That's the second to worst set of conditions, extreme drought. At what point do we shift to exceptional drought, which is the worst?
That's been an ongoing topic of conversation among our North Carolina Drought Council over the last couple of weeks. We'll see if the rain we had over the weekend is enough to hold off any degradation, but we are looking at places like Union County, where that farmer is so worried about conditions. That has been the epicenter of this dry spell since it emerged last summer. Over the last 6 months, this is the driest 6 month period on record for Monroe, dating back 129 years. So when we start talking about driest on record over that long of a time period, and we're seeing those impacts to farms, and we're seeing water restrictions and low lake levels, all that starts to point in the direction of exceptional drought. And it's been a while since we've seen one of those in North Carolina. Outside of the mountains, our last exceptional drought was back in 2008. A lot of folks will remember that 2007, 2008 drought, especially for those water restrictions that went into effect as we got to that exceptional level. So we hope that's not a sign of things to come. Again, we hope for those better rain chances over the next few weeks, but certainly that's the direction we've been trending after April that has been so warm and so dry so far.
We were talking, you and I, before the program started about the fact that you were on this program in the past. You were here in 2015, and at the time we spoke about drought here at a time when lake levels had begun to fall, and of course they did fall precipitously low in that 2008 drought. We spoke about, well, you and I didn't, but we did another program in 2023, in the fall of 2023. We did it in the summer of 2022 as well. Droughts here seem not only to be frequent, but they seem to be increasing in frequency. Would that be true, Corey?
You know, one of the big changes we've noticed, especially over the last 5 to 10 years, is that we're not seeing as many long-lived droughts like this one, but instead we're seeing shorter but more pronounced droughts. Sometimes you'll hear about these as flash droughts. A good example was the summer of 2024. We were in pretty decent shape as far as moisture goes coming out of that spring. Then we got into very hot, very dry weather in June and early July. That caused some areas of the state to go into these extreme drought conditions in the span of weeks instead of months like we have now. So, in a sense, the drought we're feeling now is a little bit different because it has been of that longer-lasting variety now going on for 6 to 8 months. But that flavor of drought really hasn't shifted a whole lot because we're still seeing these especially warm-season severe droughts happening more frequently.
Michelle, I know you're not a meteorologist, but you work in a building where there are meteorologists every time you turn the corner. They're everywhere at Channel 9. So, what are they telling you about the prospects for some relief in the near future? Anything?
Yeah, well, there is some relief coming this week, hopefully. We have a pretty good chance of rain this week. However, it's not going to be like one or two rainfalls that get us out of this. I mean, we have a deficit of 17 plus inches. We need maybe like an inch or two of rain a week over the next several weeks.
And that's unlikely.
It's hard to say right now, but I don't know that we're going to get 2 inches of rain this week.
Are these droughts that we seem to be experiencing in 2008, then 2022, and 2023, and 2015, and now, are they caused by similar, Corey, similar weather patterns or similar weather factors?
That collection of droughts that you just presented really speaks to the sensitivity of the time of year when these droughts emerge. You think back to 2015, that was really a classic summertime drought. In the Charlotte area, we didn't start drying out until May that year. We had several months of very dry weather, but because it was happening during that warmest time of the year, when evaporation rates are highest, when water demands are highest, it really didn't take that much dry weather to start seeing impacts, including water restrictions, go into place. You look back at this current drought as another example. This was more of a cool season drought, at least up until it started pushing into the spring. That meant it generally had fewer impacts on us. We weren't seeing the water restrictions back in January. We weren't seeing farmers complaining about soil moisture because they didn't have many crops in the ground over the wintertime. And then looking at the factors, a lot of times we do see some of the same large-scale patterns. We'll see high pressure that sits over the Carolinas for days or weeks at a time. That's basically the description of our April weather to this point. And then we know there are other factors like La Niña. We were in that La Niña pattern this winter. Those are generally drier than normal for our part of the country. And it was an overall dry winter this year as well.
I want to talk about La Niña and El Niño a little bit later on in the program. And I also want to talk about weather patterns because you have charted these droughts over time. Corey, we'll do that when we come back. The Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the drought, which we are in Mecklenburg County and surrounding counties in extreme drought. Farmers are feeling the pinch. We're going to talk more about that in just a moment with Dr. Jeffrey Dorfman. He's professor of agricultural and resource economics at North Carolina State University. He is here along with Michelle Alfini, climate reporter for WSOC TV, and Corey Davis, the assistant state climatologist at the North Carolina State Climate Office. Corey, you were here, you've been on this program several times. I think you were here in 2022, and we spoke about you having charted the history of this state's dry spells from 1914 at the time to 2022. Maybe you've done it further beyond 2022 now that we're 4 years beyond that. Back then, you told us the wettest year was 1929, and the driest year was 1981. Is that still the case, or have things changed since then?
We have certainly picked up some more wet years recently. 2018, when we had Hurricane Florence, along with some other big rain events. And 2020 also, when we had a lot of remnant tropical systems that moved in from the Gulf. Both of those have moved up toward the top of that list of wetter events. But it's interesting that we're seeing this drought develop now in 2026, because if we go back exactly 100 years ago, that's when we saw another one of our state's worst droughts. This initially took shape over the summer of 1925. We watched that dryness continue over the winter and then into the next spring and summer. You know, I've been looking back on some old newspaper articles from that event just this week, and it's interesting to see some similarities with where we are now. After we got one decent rain event in the spring of 1925, the newspapers were saying, okay, this dry spell is over, we're out of drought, the crops are fine again. And of course, we know that's not the way things continued. If anything, it got even hotter and even drier over that summer. So I think when we look back at especially these long-lasting droughts that happened in the mid-20s, in the 50s, in the 80s, and of course in 2007, in 2008, that's one of the big takeaways, is that when we get this level of entrenched dryness, one rain event, even one wet month, really is not going to fully get rid of that drought. We need to have sustained wet weather over the period of several months to finally make a dent in these drought conditions.
Off the air, Michelle, you were asking Corey if he was going to talk about the whiplash effect that we've been seeing recently. Explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, so as he kind of mentioned earlier, 2024 was a weird year in terms of weather. I think it averaged out that our rainfall was pretty normal, but we had a very wet spring, then a very dry summer, and then we had Hurricane Helene. And then by the end of the year, things looked normal when you put it in aggregate, but the experience for people in the state was very not normal. People had trouble planting in the spring, farmers, especially corn farmers, really struggled during the summer with their drought. And obviously, Hurricane Helene was devastating for so many people.
And you just talked about 1929 and the vagaries of what happened there. We were in, we were out of drought, etc. Are these droughts, can we blame these recent droughts, Corey, on the vagaries of weather or climate patterns or on climate change?
We are seeing especially our precipitation patterns get more extreme due to climate change, and this is really behind that weather whiplash effect that Michelle just talked about. In this type of pattern, we tend to see very unpredictable swings between the wet periods and the dry ones. Again, the summer of 2024 was a great example. We were so dry in June and early July, and then we switched to a very wet pattern for the rest of that summer. We even look back at the start of this drought, and it had a lot of those tendencies. We were fairly wet through June, July, the first part of August last year. Once we got to the middle of August, that faucet just turned off. We stopped getting those regular rain events, and we started drying out, and that was the beginning of this dry spell that now has stretched more than 6 months, and we're currently in the spring still dealing with those effects.
So drought is not just inconvenient for homeowners who want to keep their lawns green. It's really inconvenient and frightening, I would think, for people in the agricultural industry, Jeffrey. During these past dry spells that we've been alluding to here, what has been the economic impact on farmers and on agriculture when these dry spells go on and on for so long?
Sure. The impact can be hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions. So you lose yield. So farmers make less money because they end up with less crops to sell. Their production costs are higher because if they do have irrigation systems, it costs money to run those. They've got to pay for the fuel. You have often other higher costs for chemicals, because your plants that are growing in drought conditions are more susceptible to infestations from pests, right? So you know, the plants are sort of more delicate because they're already taking a blow from the drought. So you may have to spray more insecticides on them and things. So all around, farmers would prefer we not be in drought conditions.
Crops are suffering, I'm told, in 99 of the state's 100 counties. That's pretty much all of them. Is it all crops that are suffering, or are some more susceptible than others to these drought conditions, Jeffrey?
So some are more susceptible to droughts than others, but they're all suffering. There's nothing we grow that likes it to be dry. But there are some that are more susceptible.
More than 90% of the state's topsoil is, well, then not, no, let me put it this way. More than 90% of the state is short on topsoil moisture, which certainly affects agriculture, particularly, I guess, in the early parts of the growing season before these plants have had time to put down any kind of roots. At what point, however, do we begin to worry, Corey, about the availability of groundwater?
You know, we at the State Climate Office have been tracking these moisture conditions. One alarming thing has just been how quickly those topsoil moisture reserves have fallen off this spring. And of course, we've had some very hot weather. We've had some 90-degree days unusually early in the season. So that's why we're seeing that summer-like moisture decline. But as you mentioned, topsoil and subsoil moisture will also recharge our groundwater reserves. And that's one of the big takeaways from this winter. Even though we didn't feel or see a lot of drought impacts during that time of the year, because we weren't getting that recharge that we expect during the winter months, we also started watching those groundwater levels fall off then. So certainly, especially in far western North Carolina and in far eastern North Carolina, we're already seeing some wells that are at record low levels for this time of the year. Across the Piedmont, generally we have a little bit deeper groundwater reserves, so we're not as concerned at this point in the season. But, you know, thinking back to 2007, that other memorable drought, that was a takeaway. We had homeowners who had groundwater wells in their backyards, and those wells dried up. They had to go to their local city and purchase water there, or they had to go down to the creek if there was water flowing through it and draw water from those areas. So again, it's a level of dryness that we haven't seen in almost 20 years in the Carolinas. And when we see weather this dry for this long, that can affect things like groundwater availability.
And Dr. Dorfman, you were just talking about the expense of running these irrigation systems for the farmers who have them because they got to pay for the fuel that pumps the water, but the water has to be there to pump. And you have said that crop conditions have been impacted for virtually all crops that do not have sufficient irrigation. What happens when the groundwater starts to go away? I would think that most farmers are not on city water. They have to take it from, well, groundwater supplies. Where are we with that right now? Do we know?
So most irrigation is from wells. Some is from surface water, where you're pulling it right out of a river. In general, if a well goes dry, and I haven't heard a farmer saying their wells are going dry yet this year, then you either have to stop irrigating, or you try and get the drilling company to come out there and deepen your well, which is very expensive.
Farmers are very concerned about the conditions we've been experiencing, and it comes at a time, the same time that fuel prices are on the rise, and the same time where fertilizer prices evidently are increasing, and or be fertilizer is becoming in shorter supply because of the blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. This could be a perfect storm for farmers, disastrous for farmers. What do you see, Jeffrey, as the impact of these three forces coming together at the same time on the rising cost of groceries?
Sure. So let's do it in two steps. What we've seen in the last 5 years is the cost of production in North Carolina, averaged over our major crops, is up 70%. So farmers are having to spend 70% more money to grow the same crops. At the same time, the prices they're getting for those crops has actually gone down. So they're now making about $140 per acre less than they were making 5 years ago. That's a lot of money being lost by the farmers. Now, to get to our food prices in the grocery store, we need to know that about 20% of the money you spend at a grocery store ends up in a farmer's pocket. So about 20% is the cost of the sort of raw food that goes into those things. So if production costs are up 70%, then food costs would go up about 14%. Now, this is over the last 5 years, so we've already experienced this, right? Our food costs are up about 20% in the last 5 years. But what we're seeing right now, the fertilizer, the diesel, and the drought, figure could add about another 1% to the price of food at the grocery store.
I went to the grocery store over the weekend, got three bags, three little plastic bags, $70. That would have cost maybe $30 three, four, 5 years ago. And you just said that even as the price of what farmers need to grow the food has gone up, the price that they're getting for the food they grow has gone down. Why am I paying more?
You're paying more because the companies that are making the food in the grocery store are having to pay more. They've had to give all their workers a raise because all, you know, workers have generally gotten paid a lot more during this high inflation period. They're having to drive it there in trucks, paying that higher diesel price. Refrigeration costs more because that uses energy. So just all the costs of doing business for everybody is up. Food's no different.
You're the climate reporter on the panel from WSOC TV, Michelle. There are a lot of climate change deniers out there. Are we seeing that soften a little bit as we see these rising prices at the grocery store, as these droughts cause prices to rise more, as these droughts cause more and more hardship on farmers, some of whom will eventually, we're going to talk about this later, throw in the towel on all of this, and as insurance costs for disaster protection go up, are we seeing any melting of the ice when it comes to denial of climate change?
Well, we're seeing a lot of melting of ice, but in terms of denial, so the thing about climate denial is it is extremely vocal, but it is not necessarily very indicative of how people actually feel in the aggregate. Every time the question is polled, a majority of people really do believe in climate change. However, the folks who don't are very, very vocal about how they don't, and they're very entrenched in that opinion.
But there are a lot of policymakers who seem, even if they don't vocally deny it, seem to be enacting policies that are flying in the face of reality. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong. it is unfortunate. But there are a lot of other factors that those policymakers are considering that aren't necessarily, you know, in line with what some folks who believe that climate change is a real and existential threat would want to see from them. There might be more focus on short-term gains or protecting economic interests rather than promoting resilience or long-term sustainability.
Corey, you have some attitudes or some information about changing attitudes on climate change.
Right, Mike. You know, you mentioned I've been at this job at the climate office for a while now. Since the last time I think I was on your show about 10 years ago, I have noticed huge shifts in attitudes about climate change. Part of that is just because of the experience that people have had with some of our recent events. You know, you go back 10 years ago, when we would go out and give a presentation about climate change, it would be in the future tense. Here's what we expect to see 15 or 20 years from now. Here's what these long-term trends might look like. But especially beginning with Hurricane Florence back in 2018, continuing with storms like Helene, and then really exacerbated by those whiplash events in between, we have seen a lot more people realizing that these changes are not future problems, they're now problems. And I would say probably the one group that's been more receptive to this message than any have been the farmers. Because in a lot of cases, they're working on lands that their parents and grandparents have worked on for hundreds of years, and they're now seeing the weather is just acting differently than it ever did historically. We are not getting the same predictable rainfall. We are getting more unpredictable droughts, and especially with some of those hurricane events that, of course, are part of our climate in North Carolina, those look different now than they did in the past.
Yeah, farmers are on the front line of all of this, and they are also people who have historical perspective on all of this, because as you say, sometimes these farms go back generations, so they know what their grandfathers and the great-grandfathers went through and their fathers and mothers went through. Jeffrey, between 2017 and 2022, North Carolina lost over 3,600 farms translating to about 302,000 acres of farmland, which is no longer in use. Would situations like drought and these tariffs and rising diesel prices and rising costs of everything that farmers have to buy in order to grow the food that we eat, could that cause this trend of farms being sold to speed up?
Probably not. We've been consolidating for a long time. Really, what's happening is because costs have been rising faster than prices, it has become over the last really 40, 50 years in a pretty steady progression. Farmers make less money per acre. You just make less per acre. Therefore, if you want to earn a living as farming, you need more acres. So smaller farms sell out to bigger farms. The bigger farms that remain have to keep getting bigger. Right. If you make $100 an acre and you have 1,000 acres, you can make $100,000 a year. Once you start making $50 an acre, you need 2,000 acres to make that same $100,000 a year. And that's kind of what happens.
I don't understand why food prices keep falling. If I'm paying more and the demand is still there and it's harder to grow the food in the first place, why aren't farmers being compensated for all of that?
Well, partly it's because in the major commodities, so sort of your corn, soybeans, wheat, things like that, they're global markets. And one of the things that's happened the last several years is we haven't had crop failures in those crops anywhere in the world. If the rest of the world all has good crops, if Brazil and Argentina and China do a good job of growing corn and soybeans, then the price of corn and soybeans is going to be low.
So is anybody keeping tabs? Because some of these farmers are selling out to housing developments. So the land is valuable to build new houses, et cetera. Is anybody keeping tab of the balance of selling that out versus keeping enough farms in operation to keep our food supply staple? Jeffrey?
Yes, we are. So I work on farmland preservation. So we do keep an eye on that. And the good news is that we're losing a very small amount of farmland on a percentage basis in North Carolina, and that farmers' productivity has been going up faster than the acres farmed have been going down. So we're actually growing more corn and soybean than we used to.
Dr. Jeffrey Dorfman is a professor of agriculture and resource economics at North Carolina State University. When we come back, what happens in extreme drought? What are we looking for? We'll talk about that in a moment in Charlotte Talk. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the extreme drought that we are living through right now in Mecklenburg County and most of the western counties in North Carolina, certainly those surrounding us, with Dr. Jeffrey Dorfman, who's a professor of agricultural and resource economics at North Carolina State University. Corey Davis is the assistant state climatologist with the North Carolina State Climate Office. And Michelle Alfini is with us. She's a climate reporter for WSOC-TV. Mecklenburg and surrounding counties, as I just said, are in extreme drought. According to the North Carolina Drought Management Advisory Council, this is the stage when aquatic life begins to die, when hydropower generation decreases, and the hay supply begins to become scarce. Michelle, talk about those first two. Has Duke, which runs the Catawba River Basin and the dams on it, have they decreased the amount of power that we're generating from those dams at the moment? Do we have reports on aquatic life now beginning to suffer?
I haven't yet seen reports on aquatic life, but I do know that Duke Energy is getting lower output out of those hydroelectric dams, especially now that the lake levels have dropped pretty significantly in Lake Norman, Lake Wiley, and Mountain Island Lake. They can't, you know, put as much water through those dams as they normally would because they need to manage them so that the lake levels stay above a certain threshold.
Right, because and Mountain Island Lake, Mountain Island Lake is where Charlotte gets its drinking water. Jeffrey, one of the last times we spoke about farmers on this program being impacted by drought, the availability of sufficient hay was a topic at the time to feed livestock, because without that, they can't feed them. Is that a concern now?
It's a huge concern. You've been talking about rising food prices. One of the food prices that has risen the most has been beef prices. And the reason your steak and your ground beef are costing more in the store is because farmers have been raising fewer and fewer cows. And the reason is because they don't have the pasture grass because of droughts. And because of droughts, buying extra hay has been very, very expensive and difficult to find. So farmers simply figure, why start raising calves if we're not going to be able to afford to feed them?
Fewer calves, fewer beef on the grocery store shelves and in the restaurants. We have these weather makers, Corey, in the Pacific, El Nino and La Nina. Which of those, if either of them, is affecting us in this drought now?
Well, really both, at least if we're looking out through the end of the year. The last 2 years, especially the last 2 winters, we have been in a La Nina pattern. Now that tends to shift the jet stream and the storm track to our north. And that's why this winter, even though we got a few events and even one decent snow, for the most part, we missed out on the rain that we expect at that time of the year. But we are currently watching that La Nina pattern fade, shifting over to what we expect will be a pretty strong El Nino. You may see some headlines that are talking about Super El Nino or Godzilla El Nino by the end of the year. So we do expect that will eventually bring some better rain chances to us. El Nino tends to bring a much stronger storm track that's anchored to our south. So especially during the fall and winter months, that can bring more reliable precipitation. But again, that's a long time to wait for some potential relief. That means if we don't see better rain until that El Nino sets up, we could have another 6 months of this drought in store.
Is that because when that thing settles to the south of us, we're getting that southwesterly flow of air bringing Gulf moisture into the atmosphere and causing more rain?
That's
And
exactly right. When you see this El Nino pattern, we tend to have that jet stream and storm track that moves right over the Gulf, usually right up along our coastline as well. And that jet stream is a conveyor belt. It's bringing along weather systems, it's bringing along moisture. So when you get in that strong El Nino pattern, that happened back in the fall of 2015, we can see some really wet weather and some really wet months. Certainly, that could be a big drought buster. But again, that's a little long way away to wait for that wetter pattern to return.
No one wants to see hurricanes, but hurricanes do bring a lot of moisture with them, a lot of rainfall with them, and certainly the last several have brought disastrous amounts of rainfall. What do you know about the forecast this summer for the potential of hurricanes to help out with this drought a little bit?
Well, you're right. A lot of times we say the best cure to a drought in North Carolina is a good hurricane. Of course, we don't like the other hazards that those bring, but a good multi-day soaking rain event would not be the worst thing to happen right now. And it's an interesting forecast for this hurricane season. We are going into it with very warm water across the Atlantic, similar story as we've had over the last couple years. So we think that could mean more early season storms forming. And historically, the North Carolina coast is one of the favored spots to see those early season storms. Again, that could be a recipe for some good rain, maybe a weak tropical storm right off our coast to bring some pretty good rain amounts in these drought-affected areas. Later in the year, once this El Nino pattern sets up, it tends to hold down activity. And that's because those very strong upper-level winds will shear or tear apart developing storms. So I'm expecting we could see more activity in the first couple months of the season. Once we get to or just past the peak of the season in September, we may see a lot of that activity stop. So if we're still waiting on a good tropical rainstorm to bring us some precipitation, we may be out of luck, at least through the fall.
Michelle, when we reach a state of extreme drought, that is when voluntary water restrictions go into place, and they are in place right now in Mecklenburg County. Officials have asked for outdoor watering to take place only 2 days a week. Odd number addresses on Tuesday and Saturday, even number addresses on Wednesday and Sunday. I'm not sure what happens the rest of the days that are not part of that. But has this been publicized enough? Are property owners aware of it? Are they cooperating?
Well, it's hard to say. Judging by the crunchiness of the grass I've seen, I think some people are, taking that into effect. I haven't seen too many people sprinkling in the middle of the day, but that might just be because they're smart enough to know that's not very effective. I think, we can try and make these voluntary water restrictions as publicized as possible. People really have to do their part, and until there's some kind of enforcement, you're really just betting on the goodwill of people. And I think hopefully, as more information comes out about the drought, more people are willing to, step back and think about conservation. But we'll see.
Union County, as of last week, implemented stage one of their drought plan. What does that mean to citizens there?
Stage one of the drought plan. I believe that is still voluntary restrictions. I think stage two is when we start getting into those mandatory restrictions where there is some kind of enforcement action.
Right. And over in Union County, I think they closed the lakes in Monroe to recreation at the start of the spring season. What conditions are they experiencing on those lakes that would cause them to do that?
Yes. So one of the issues that happens when we have lower lake levels and reservoirs start, dropping in those levels, having less water, that means that the water that you're drawing, your drinking water from, is more susceptible to getting infected or getting some kind of gross stuff growing in it. Like, you don't want small amounts of water sitting. You want as much water in those reservoirs as possible so that bacteria doesn't grow. And because of that, they closed the water to recreation because lakes can, when you're boating on them, that stirs up the water, that can increase turbidity or the kind of cloudiness of the water, and that can impact what they're drawing from.
I've read that they haven't had lake levels in Monroe this low since 2008, but Monroe has only gotten 2 inches of rain since last August, which seems incredibly small. The last time Mecklenburg County had water use restrictions, that I can remember at least, lake levels were noticeably low. And you already referred, Michelle, to our Catawba River Basin having low levels. How low are things? How far below normal are they at the moment? Do you know?
I don't know off the top of my head. I know it's at least a few feet, but if you happen to go to Lake Monroe, things look very bad. There are piers just kind of sitting several feet out of the water, floating piers that usually, would be floating in that water, are feet away from shore. That lake is down, I think it was at least 12 feet when I visited, and I think it's only gotten worse. That was a couple of weeks ago. But Lake Monroe in particular, they're lowering it so that they can raise the level of a lake a bit downstream where they're actually drawing their reservoir water. I think that's Lake Twitty. But even Lake Twitty is down quite a few feet.
Corey, the last time we, I think, experienced water levels in the Catawba River Basin drop to worrisome levels, it was 2007 in the drought that summer, and that drought had been building during the cooler months, kind of like now, when evaporation isn't as quick. And right now, maybe that's why we're not seeing extremely low levels, because it's cooler. But it's about to get a lot hotter. We've already had some hot days. What will that do if things continue the way they are now?
Yeah, one of the concerns about this drought is compared to 2007, we're much deeper in the hole as far as those rainfall deficits go. In the Charlotte area in 2007, it really took until that spring, especially April and May, before things started to noticeably dry out and we started building up those rainfall deficits. As we've mentioned right now, we're more than 15 inches below our normal rainfall over these last 8 months. So if it does stay hot and if it does stay dry here over these next few months, that means we're already starting with really a head start on this developing dryness. And I think that's why you're starting to see a lot of the local water systems and towns go ahead and put those restrictions into place. We know the lake levels are not as low right now as they were back in 2007, but they're taking the lessons learned from that drought and they're taking the prospect of an ongoing drought seriously. They want to make sure that we're already starting to manage our supplies so that just in case this drought does last for the rest of the year, that we're able to keep some of those main impacts to people under control.
I'm not sure whether to ask you, Corey, or to ask Michelle this question, but another concern when it comes to these exceedingly long dry conditions is fire. We've seen wildfires ravage California last year. We're seeing them right now in southern Georgia and in parts of Florida. We do have a statewide burn ban in effect in North Carolina because of the dry conditions. How concerned should we be about wildfires at this point? Which one of you wants to take a crack at that? Okay,
I
Corey,
can
go
go for
ahead.
this one because I've been in close conversations with North Carolina Forest Service in recent weeks. I'll say they are taking this threat very seriously. We know this is that time of the year when we tend to see fires even in wet years. That's because we're still watching that vegetation come out of its dormancy in the wintertime. That tends to make it a little more flammable until it's fully greened up and leafed out. Well, that greenup process has been delayed this year. We've had enough cold nights with frost and freezes that those have been setbacks. We've also got so little moisture in the ground right now that the roots of these plants just can't soak anything up. So that is slowing down this greenup process. And then we look at those big fires down to our south in parts of Florida and Georgia. And the concern is that if we don't get better rain soon, that could happen in parts of eastern North Carolina. You go back to the 2008 drought. That spring, we had some very long-lasting, intense fires burning at our coast. Again, this is a product for being this dry for this long. So, fingers crossed we do get some better rain over the next few weeks. But if we don't, then we could expect this burn ban to continue and have more wildfire activity in our backyard here in North Carolina.
Michelle.
And then in the West, there's also concern with just the amount of tree fall and debris that we still have lying around from Hurricane Helene. A lot of that has dried out. And if a fire starts in the wrong place, that could be a tinderbox that spreads very rapidly.
Jeffrey, this is not exactly a crop growing question, but Channel 9 reports that drought conditions are impacting bees, and bees certainly affect crops because they pollinate them. Without the bees, we don't eat. So I don't know if it qualifies as agriculture, but evidently, despite all of the pollen that we had this spring, drought impacts that, and it impacts nectar levels, and that impacts how much honey bees produce. Bees have been stressed now for years. What is the danger here?
Well, again, one very practical outcome of this is cost. So farmers that count on bees to pollinate their crops have had to actually put out sugar water for the bees to eat because the normal nectar that they would eat from the plants has become too sort of sticky because the plants aren't getting enough moisture. So those plants don't have enough water in them to make proper nectar, and the bees couldn't get food. So to keep the bees fed so they'll keep working, farmers have had to pay to put out food for the bees. Well, bees tend to die a lot, and we breed new bees all the time. So I think we'll be okay in terms of the number of bees, but it's just another way that farmers are having to pay more money.
A recent United Nations report warns that a lot of water systems worldwide are moving towards short-term shortages into more persistent imbalance, something that researchers refer to as water bankruptcy. That's when long-term use outpaces natural systems, the speed at which natural systems can replenish. Is any state in our system, any state in our country, facing those conditions, Corey?
I think this speaks to that weather whiplash sort of pattern that we're feeling in North Carolina, more extremes on both ends with our heavy precipitation, but also with these more severe droughts coming up. And thinking about how water demands have changed in North Carolina over time, again, I go back to that mid-1920s drought. At that point, we did not have those large lakes and reservoirs that we use both for flood storage and for water storage during times of drought. So water supply was a very different issue back then. Now we know the population of North Carolina has more than tripled over that past century. So that is putting new pressures, new demands on our water supply. And this drought we're in now is really the first test of 21st century North Carolina as far as its drought resilience.
Michelle, I have about 30 seconds left. We're all sitting here listening to this. Last time we talked about drought, we were told that every time we turn a light switch on, we're using water because we generate power through hydroelectric power in this region. What can homeowners do? What should they be doing? What should property owners be doing right now if they want to aid this situation?
I would be careful with how you use water and careful with how you use electricity. It's not just hydroelectric power. Steam stations, coal, any kind of natural gas, they heat water to turn turbines. So they are using water as well. And even if that
Right.
goes back in the system, that's still drawing water at the time.
Michelle Alfini is a climate reporter for WSOC-TV. She was here along with Corey Davis, assistant state climatologist at the North Carolina State Climate Office, and Dr. Jeffrey Dorfman, professor of agricultural and resource economics at North Carolina State University. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.